Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the United Road podcast. As always, a very interesting week at Manchester United. You know, a terrible, terrible Thursday afternoon at Sevilla, which probably saw us play as badly as we have, you know, the entire season. We saw a 3-0 drubbing, two goalkeeping errors, one defensive error. We were pretty much all over the place for those 90 minutes. There were high expectations from that game. Hopefully a potential treble run-in, but it all came to an end. We played some really bad games this season, some big losses away from home. But the quality of the performance this time around wasn't up to the mark. Later on the Sunday, we went to Brighton, another informed team under Roberto De Serbi. The game itself was frantic, an excellent viewing for the neutral. Eventually, did go to penalties. United did end up keeping that cool and we're off to our second final. We just come to a point where we're not able to make out what to understand of this Manchester United side. One big game, we're good. The other big game, we're not. But all in all, I think we're progressing in the right direction. But let's get right into it for today's podcast. We're going to review both those games, also preview the big week coming up in the Premier League, and also spend some time on the prospect of the Manchester Derby, which is going to be the final of the FA Cup. So we'll get us started with Rushabh today. Rushabh, why don't you share your thoughts on that dreadful afternoon in Sevilla, which saw us lose 3-0 to a side that we utterly dominated for the 90 at Old Trafford. Over to you, Rushabh.
Thanks, Amai. I think the Sevilla game was, it was weirdly inexplicable and also very, very typical at the same time. It was inexplicable in that we were, we were so excited to have our midfield back. One of the biggest things we spoke about in the preview for the second leg was that we have Casemiro, Eriksen, and I guess Bruno not back for this game. We have Casemiro and Eriksen back, which is such a big thing for the team. Even though we've lost both the centre-backs, they provide a lot of stability. And it was inexplicable how we were so poor on the ball. Even if you take away the mistakes for the goals, which obviously were big mistakes, the team was just not at the races. We saw Casemiro misplace a couple of really poor passes that could have led to goals as well, which is just so unlike him. I think the loss, not having Bruno Fernandes was a big problem. And not having Bruno Fernandes and having Sabitzer be his replacement, I think, was one of another big problems. Sabitzer's been great. In that forward role, especially when Bruno kind of comes in behind and plays those passes. Like we saw in the first leg, Bruno finding him, and then for the other goal, Martial finding him when he made those late runs. But no one was able to find him when he was making those late runs in this game. And on the ball, he was like a big liability. Offensively, he had no shots on target, only one key pass, no dribbles completed. Defensively, all he had was one tackle and one clearance all game. Nothing else. Passing accuracy very low, below 60%. So I think Marcel Sabitzer's performance just shone a very, very, very big light on how important Bruno Fernandes is to this team, and which is something we also saw evidence for in the semi-final against Brighton. The difference Bruno Fernandes makes to this team on and off the pitch. So I think that was a very, very big thing that was highlighted in the Sevilla game. In case there's a part of the United fan base that does not value what Bruno Fernandes brings to this team, I think it was a great indicator of that. I mean, there really isn't much for us to say about Maguire and De Gea. This is, been there, done that a million times. We were discussing off camera about how Maguire's probably done. He's probably played his last game for United, barring maybe, a dead rubber last game of the season if he've already made top four. A lot of people think, and maybe people over here, we also think that De Gea should not be playing anymore. Well, not all of us, but maybe some of us. Reports of him getting a new contract off the back of that game just feel wrong. It just doesn't feel right. De Gea has not covered himself in glory at all, even since then. We've won a penalty shootout, but De Gea had almost nothing to do with any of it. So I think the Sevilla game, hopefully, if there's a silver line to take from here, is that look, to be a more of a devil's advocate, we've been talking about how we were fighting on all three fronts, and eventually something was going to happen. We could not have kept this pace up for the entire season. We're getting suspensions, injuries left, right, and center. But hopefully, if there's one shining light to take from this game, and this is, this is one thing we want to take from the game, is that hopefully this gives more direction to a summer sellout. Hopefully this gives more direction in terms of what the squad building has to be. It helps us make some harsh decisions. I think decisions need to be made on De Gea, and it seems like the wrong one is being made. I think decisions need to be discussed around Anthony Martial, and this game might help with that. And I think a lot more, yeah, I think just a lot of, hopefully this is sparking discussion in the boardroom for Manchester United, because this game wasn't good enough. But you know what? You can't win every trophy, unfortunately. And I think the focus should be on a very, very, very tactically good performance against Brighton, which I'm sure we'll get to soon.
Absolutely. I think, you hit the nail on the head, Rushabh, especially with how we were in the game against Sevilla. It really showed so many deficiencies, you know, in the squad, especially, our performance away from home. We've lost away to City. We've lost away to Liverpool. We've lost away to Newcastle. And the trend just continues as we went into that game against Sevilla. And I want to ask Advaith over here. I mean, it was a very hostile crowd. One that really put the pressure on, on us as soon as, the whistle blew. They were absolutely on it. It showed why they've had so much success in the competition. But what happens to us in these away games? Is it a mentality issue? Is it an experience issue? Do you think some of the players just need to move on? Are they not able to grasp the ideology? What is happening away from home, in your opinion, at that?
I think it's a lot of these factors coming together, but more importantly, like the teams that you named, like we lost at the Emirates, we lost at the Etihad, we lost at St. James's Park, we lost at Anfield. So all these grounds, they're really historic grounds, and just like coming to United is a dreadful task for any team in the world right now. Going to these grounds is really challenging as well, and people don't realize that when we're talking about these away records. Like City have lost one game all season in the Premier League at the Etihad. Liverpool, as bad a season as they're having, they've beaten every top side at Anfield, which is actually crazy. Newcastle are really good at home as well. And Arsenal at the Emirates, I mean, what, they've lost just against City and they drew against Brentford, right? That's it. And I mean, what I'm trying to say is all these sides that we're naming, that we're talking about mentality issues, pressure, just like we are really good at Old Trafford, they are extremely difficult to beat at their homes as well. And a lot of this is down to the home support. Like, you know, especially at the Etihad, like, I just wanted to address this at some point in the podcast, but a lot of people say that the Etihad doesn't fill up and the empty hat jokes and stuff, but City have actually sold out 99% of their home stadium in every single match of the Premier League, which makes them among the top three in the league. So City actually have sold out their stadium most of the time. The crowd is buzzing. And I mean, one of my friends who studies in Manchester and goes to these games is aware of the fact that they usually sell out and they have a good crowd. Anfield is always buzzing. So I feel a lot of these players do get, you know, intimidated by the atmosphere. And, you know, more than that, something that we've addressed in the podcast before is that when United concede one goal, they really let go of the principles that they're adhering to. And after that, it just spirals on. And like Marcus Rashford addressed as well, that after they conceded two goals at Anfield, they're just trying to find the third and just chaos ensues all over the pitch. So I think that's one thing that's contributed to United not coming back as often as we're used to seeing. Because once these two goals go in, every player's, you know, just out of position and making it easier for the opponents to score in these away games. So it's normal to go down in these away games, but we've found ways to come back in the past, but we're not doing that because we're not sticking to the principles. Another contributing factor to these things is that Ten Hag has just joined United. Like, as good as he's been, it's been just one season. We're still learning how to react to when we concede goals early, how to react to different game states and what he wants of this team. So there is probably still more clarity to be given to the players. And once that comes in, I'm sure we'll start reacting better. We'll start behaving more maturely on the pitch and, you know, it'll just become better. So yeah, I think it's the crowd factor, the crowd being intimidating, United still gaining clarity on what to do in each game state and, you know, just handling these special situations and not letting them spiral out of control.
Excellent. I think you've addressed a lot of key issues that have come up over the season. A lot of work to be done in preseason. It also gives Ten Hag an idea of the kind of players he wants to bring in, you know, folks with some experience or at least, you know, a little bit of dog in them to be able to go out there and play these big games with authority as well as they do, you know, at Manchester, at Old Trafford, really. So I think it's something we want to learn, you know, to do better. We do have the opportunity to correct that as we face Spurs in midweek. It's an important game away from home. An opportunity to correct the record. And, you know, we're going to get to that preview, you know, shortly after. But, you know, moving on from the debacle at Sevilla, I do want to spend some time on Sunday, which was a real high, you know, against a Brighton side that were actually odds on favorite to win that game, believe it or not. You can see why they were. They were outstanding, you know, for a lot of part of majority of the game, especially Casado, who really dominated that battle with Casemiro. You can see why, you know, he's found a lot of admirers around the Premier League. And I can see, you know, Ten Hag even considering him to be a part of Manchester United come the summer. But I'll move on to you, Rushabh. What do you think of that game? I mean, it was nerve-wracking. I could not really watch the penalties. It was a very nervous moment. We've lost 7 out of our 8 penalty shootouts before this. De Gea has actually never been a part of a successful penalty shootout. It's almost like he's a ghost in front of the penalties, but somehow Weghorst kisses the ball and we come out on top. So Rushabh, what do you think? What do you think of that 120 minutes that we spent at Wembley, and what are your thoughts on the game?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I think if my math is right, we're over 20 or 21 penalties since De Gea last saved a penalty in a penalty shootout. Or even more, I think, actually. But that's besides the point. I think it's good for the team. I think we've discussed this on the podcast earlier that all of our big losses this season, and there have been quite a few big losses this season, have been followed by wins, have been followed by good, solid performances. And yeah, before I get to the overall performance as a whole, I do want to kind of talk about this whole penalty thing, because it is interesting. Because as a United fan, you know, it is when I was growing up and I was a bit more naive about things, I always thought of penalties for us as a good thing, because we obviously won the Champions League, you know, with penalties 2008. And like since then, it's been like every time we go to penalties, we end up messing up. And it might not be that big a deal, but to see all our, you know, everyone score their penalty, everyone take really good penalties, and to see the team win, I think that says a lot about the team's character. And I mean, we're seeing all these clips come out post-game of, you know, Bruno just coaching his players, you know, Casemiro putting his hand up to take the pen. I think all of these are just good signs. In terms of the game, I agree, Nima. I think it was such an interesting game. And I think it's the kind of game United fans are going to have to get used to watching more often, and actually have to start enjoying watching these kind of games more often. Because for huge parts of it didn't look like we were dominating. And we weren't, but we also weren't incredibly open. Like, you know, the teams were very even. We and Brighton both had 15 attempts. And 7 of Brighton attempts came from set pieces. Only 8 came from open play as opposed to our 11. So I think it was a very, 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 very disciplined performance. We saw Rashford and Antony, who were tasked, along with Martial, tasked with a lot of pressing, a lot of defensive duties. You know, Martial was being tasked with, like, you know, making sure the ball isn't getting to the 2 number 6s, to McAllister and Caicedo. We saw Rashford and Antony also coming narrower, so that the ball was being pushed out to the wings, which was big for us. You know, I was reading about how a lot of Brighton's build-up play, which, you know, everyone is just, you know, going gaga about, a lot of Brighton's build-up play happens through the middle, and we were just cutting all those passing lanes, which I think was a big, big, big positive. And like, you know, just seeing that discipline from the squad, this is what Zed was talking about earlier, where it's like, you know, if we'd conceded a goal, I could have seen us kind of spiral and lose that defensive structure and lose that discipline. But that wasn't happening. And, you know, luckily we didn't concede. And that's the kind of thing that the team has to get better at doing consistently over 90 minutes and over a season, not just for some games. And right now we're not at the stage where we can dominate ball playing and high pressing sides like Brighton. So seeing the team adapt and seeing Ten Hag adapt and playing this very disciplined, you know, system, I think it was great. I think it was great to see. And I think we played to our strengths. Like, you know, the biggest stat I think that came out of the game was that we had 10 high turnovers, which is like, you know, having a turnover which is within 40 meters of the Brighton goal. We had 10 of them, which I think is really good. I think is that's like, that just goes to show how good our pressing was, and a lot of our chances were coming from that. Maybe we should have scored in normal time, but you know what, a win is a win. And I think very disciplined, very good performance, and nullified Brighton in that, other than a couple of moments, I was never really that scared. Very good, very competitive game, great to watch, and I think great signs for United.
Yeah, fantastic. I think, you know, I agree. It was a, you know, fantastic United performance, fantastic Brighton performance too. Credit must be given to them as well for showing up to Wembley. They've actually never won at Wembley before. It's still a club in progress. But, you know, they ditched a lot of character. You know, just moving to the tactical side of things, you know, this was You know, really a fantastic watch for somebody who's you know, craves a tactical experience of the modern manager. It almost felt like you know, Ten Hag and De Zerbi weren't really looking to attack each other as much as looking to nullify each other. And I want to ask Edved in terms of what he really thought of the tactical setup from the two managers. Of course, De Zerbi, you know, is known for baiting. He's known for, you know, playing a lot of possession football. They did have 64% of the possession in the first half. But Ten Hag makes a fabulous change and Fred comes on, you know, in the midfield in place of Eriksen, and the energy of the game completely changes. He brings on Hoetbeggers later on. We're creating chances out of a high press, which doesn't usually happen against Brighton. But I just want to ask him about what he thought of the tactical setup and how, what was his read on the game, really?
No, definitely, it was a very interesting game, and Ten Hag and De Zerbi were completely at it, and you could see how prepared they've come coming into this game. I was actually a little bit surprised that Brighton weren't pressing us very high, and that kind of just showed that they were a little intimidated by the occasion and they weren't their natural selves. But also, I would like to highlight one of the main reasons for this. Like, after the disastrous David De Gea performance in Seville in possession on Thursday and out of possession, like, De Gea was horrible. It was one of his worst games. Like, he usually doesn't perform when it matters, right? So, of course. But Sevilla were continuously hurrying De Gea's passing. And so what Ten Hag did was just he instructed him to go long and direct, like he did after the Brighton and Brentford defeats at the start of the season. Against Liverpool, he was just instructed to go long and direct. David De Gea made as many passes, 30 plus meters from goal, in the first 18 minutes of this match as he did in 90 versus Seville. And 31 out of the 49 passes that he gave crossed the halfway line, the most for any game that David De Gea has played in the last five seasons. So we clearly see what Ten Hag was trying to do. The instructions were very clear that, brother, just don't try to show us that you can pass a football. Just hit it long. This is a semi-final. We need to win. We got to play on June 3rd. Honestly, this was expected from Ten Hag after what happened on Thursday. Like, we all knew that this will be the instruction, especially since Brighton win the ball back in their attacking third five times per game since Roberto De Zerbi took over, which is among the highest in the Premier League and highest among all the English sides across all competitions. So if De Gea tried to play the ball short here, we'd be in real trouble. So that was actually pretty clever from Ten Hag, but expected again. Nullifying Kauro Mitoma was so important because Mitoma has been the shining light for Brighton since the turn of the year, and he's just been so electric on that left wing for Brighton. But again, he admitted on Stadium Astro that he was completely dominated by Van Bissaka, and Bissaka won the battle. He could not complete a single dribble against him, and Bissaka comprehensively won the battle and, you know, shut down the left flank, which is where a bulk of the attacks come from. I thought the pairing of Shaw and Lindelof was great as well. And I thought Dalot was a little shaky at left back at times, but Shaw did an excellent job at covering for him at the back. And Lindelof was doing what he has done really well throughout the season and since Ten Hag took over. He was managing space really well. He just knew when to be when the crosses were coming in. And he wasn't afraid to, you know, go in for the duels. And, you know, he was actually making last-ditch tackles, which was so refreshing to see, you know. He was putting his body on the line to prevent Brighton players from getting their shots away. So that was really good. And I'm going to touch on another tactical aspect that Rushabh already spoke about. And this impressed me the most. So since we were going direct with goal kicks, since we were completely bypassing the midfield and the defense to a certain extent, it was really difficult, I would say actually impossible, to build play and create chances with slick passing or, you know, interplay like we have done for a majority of the season. So what Ten Hag did was, you know, we pressed Brighton high in our attacking third. And like Rushabh said, we ended up regaining possession within a 40-meter radius of their goal 10 times in the game, which is the most that any team has registered versus Brighton since the start of the season. So that just shows how well we pressed. We pressed Brighton the best in our attacking third than any team has in the Premier League so far, even City or even Arsenal. So I really enjoyed that from Ten Hag. Like, you know, like if we didn't have that high press, we'd basically create no chances. It would be a very dull game and, you know, it would just be soaking up pressure, or it would be like, you know, just wait for when Brighton will score that inevitable goal and, you know, knock us out of another cup competition. But this was really clever from Ten Hag. It was a risky and a bold setup, but one that worked really well. So all in all, we had to be pragmatic in our approach after what happened on Thursday. United could not afford to suffer another defeat like that. We did that. The game went to penalties and it was a miracle that we won on penalties, considering we have probably the least competent penalty saver in the history of our beautiful sport. But I just like to mention that it was so nice to see Sancho and Marcus Rashford beating their Wembley ghosts. Like when Sancho came off to take that penalty, all I could think about was his miss and Donnarumma saving that penalty and, you know, just feeling so bad for Sancho. And then Rashford putting it wide of the goalpost and that hurting as well. So it was really nice to see both of them put their hands up and, you know, just say that. Like it was lovely to see Luke Shaw say that, you know, I went to Jadon and said, look, it's okay. Like just try to forget about it. There's a new penalty kick. And the fact that Sancho came in and, like, you know, with all the hate that he's getting and, you know, people, you know, showing displeasure at his performance, is coming in and putting it top corner on the left. Like that was so beautiful to see. Like after that moment, I couldn't be sad, even if he lost the penalty shootout, to be honest. And then Rashford almost missing, but still getting it in. So huge up to those boys. And I hope they have a really good end of the season. But yeah, now really looking forward to the final on 3rd June. Like even though it's unlikely that we'll win, but you know, it's a final, it's a one-off. Anything can happen in finals. But yeah, really excited for that.
Lovely. You know, I think, you know, there are a couple of really interesting points that I want to sort of elaborate on. And one of which is the amount of, you know, hate United players get, a amount of scrutiny, really, that is, you know, on these players. And the one player that I really want to mention, actually want to mention two, and I'll mention the second one after we finish discussing the first, and that is Victor Lindelof. You know, he's often mentioned in the same breath as Harry Maguire. But they're actually two mutually exclusive and two very different players. Lindelof is more of the Ten Hag mold of a centre-back as opposed to Harry Maguire. He really put in a wonderful shift against Brighton, definitely man of the match, wonderful penalty to win it for us as well. You know, we're lacking two of our starting centre-backs and all of a sudden you see Lindelof you know, putting in that kind of performance against a fantastic Brighton side. They were missing their striker, but irrespective of that, I think Lindelof was fantastic. You know, as Rushabh said, we probably, you know, foresee Maguire leaving United at the end of the season, you know, hopefully for some extra money. The question is, what happens to Lindelof? Is he good enough to be United's, you know, third choice centre back? Coming off the bench, is he good enough to be replacing either Varane or Licha on either side? What do we think of him? Because, you know, I've always really liked him and it looks like every time he's played for us this season, you know, he's put in a shift. The boy does have some character. So to start with you, Rushabh, what are your thoughts on, you know, our man of the match from the Brighton game?
Yeah, I think that's the perfect way to put it. Man of the match from the Brighton game for sure. I don't see a world in which this squad doesn't do well with Lindelof in it, or doesn't, like, you know, doesn't need Lindelof in it. I think we have to be realistic with Varane, and I think on this podcast we very much are, in terms of, you know, Varane's injury record is not great. Yeah, he stopped playing for France, but in general Varane's injury record is not great. Even if his injury record was like flawless, just having two centre-backs, you know, we spoke off-camera about how, like, some of the outs this summer might be Tuan Zibi-Jones, regardless of the fact that they aren't playing. If we say we do lose Jones, Tuan Zibi, Maguire and Eric Bailly, which is very likely this summer, there's no way we can lose another centre-back, and be it any centre-back. And now if that centre-back in question is Victor Lindelof, you know, captain of the Swedish national team, we're seeing every time he's called up, he's performing for the most part. And I think what you said, like, because Lindelof gets mentioned in the same breath as Maguire, a lot of his attributes are just undervalued. Like, for example, Ved spoke about how he was, like, putting his body on the line. That's a very Victor Lindelof thing. I remember in Mourinho's last season in 18-19, I think this is after Mourinho was gone, so this was Ollie, I forget which game it was, but, like, Victor Lindelof, like, pulled a muscle in his groin with, like, 5 or 6 minutes of the game to go. But it was, you know, very tight game. I think it was against Arsenal. Very tight, very intense game. And he just kept going until the end. You know, there's a really famous, you know, last-ditch tackle he makes against City once, you know, one of the times when we beat City at the Etihad with Ollie. Like, Lindelof putting his body on the line and being this, like, being this really smart, astute defender is not something new. Like, we've seen it all the time. I think the only question that needs to be asked about Lindelof's position in the squad is that will he accept it? You know, he's reaching that time in his career where, you know, this is as good as it's going to get. And does he want his as good as it's going to get to be at as number three for Manchester United? That makes sense. Be the number, you know, the third choice centre back. And I think that's a question for him. I don't know if he would accept that. But if he does, I think we should be doing everything to keep him. We have a lot of money we need to spend this summer. We cannot be looking for another centre back replacement. Centre backs don't come cheap. And I mean, just what, like, he's the Iceman. What a penalty! A ridiculous penalty. You know, so good carrying the ball out of the defense. I think we have to do everything to keep him. And as third choice, I think he's perfect. It just comes down to, is he okay with that?
No, absolutely. I think I concur with your assessment of Lindelof. I've really liked him. He's actually played the least amount of minutes he's ever played, you know, in the season at United. He's really been fourth choice, and that's largely to do with the fact that Maguire has the captain's armband. But you know, there are a few other players I want to talk about in relation to what happens to them in the summer, keeping in mind the performance that they put in, and I'll give this opportunity to Advait since he's quite passionate about some of them. You know, one of them being Aaron Wan-Bissaka. I think he's, you know, that did, you know, elaborate on him. And the other one being Fred. As soon as Fred came onto the pitch against Brighton, it was a different energy. You know, he scored 6 goals, you know, since the turn of the World Cup. He does definitely bring something to the squad, but is it enough? Is it enough for him to be, you know, keeping his place in the squad? Is he good enough to be third or fourth choice midfielder at United? What happens to these two guys? Because, you know, they've been, you know, long-lasting servants of the club. It almost felt like it was time for them to go, and all of a sudden, you know, they're showing something that they haven't before. So, Edward, what are your thoughts on these two guys? Do you think they stick around for the summer?
McTominay and Wan-Bissaka, right?
Fred and Wan-Bissaka.
So, yeah, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, I think, will get a contract extension. I think since the turn of the year, Aaron Wan-Bissaka has definitely improved. And, you know, I just think that in games like these, like especially against electrifying left wingers, and I think right now there are more electrifying left wingers than there have been in the past. I think Aaron Wan-Bissaka is really, really important. And he's also, you can see that he's trying to improve his offensive game. Like Aaron Wan-Bissaka's amount of dribbles that he's completing per game has almost gone up by 0.5 since the turn of the year. So he's definitely trying to take his man on more. His crossing, you know, he's trying to find, he's trying to do the cutbacks more often than just blindly put in those crosses for someone to head in. So you can definitely see that he's using his head more while going forward. And I think Ten Hag can help him with that side of the game. Definitely can. I just think Bissaka is too big of an asset defensively to be let go of, especially at a time where we want to be able to compete for the titles. But again, I honestly think that anything could happen because, you know, the media continuously feeds us that he's just not a type of fullback that Ten Hag likes, and he wants someone to continuously overlap. And, you know, he loves Jeremy Frimpong because of the offensive threat that he brings. So it'll be a really interesting situation to look at. But I think from what I'm reading and what I genuinely believe, I think Aaron Wan-Bissaka will get a contract and stay at United beyond the summer. Coming to Fred, I think, while Fred has had really impactful performances since the turn of the year, you can definitely see that when we have fit midfielders, like when we have Eriksen, Sabitzer, or even Casemiro, he'd always prefer Sabitzer, Casemiro, or even he'd prefer Eriksen, Casemiro, or even prefer playing Bruno Fernandes deeper. But Ten Hag really has not used Fred as a starting option. Fred was, in fact, the most substituted player in the Premier League 3 weeks back. I think now it could be Jacob Murphy, I'm not wrong. But that just kind of says that while he likes the fact that Fred brings freshness off the bench, I don't think he views him as a long-term starting option or, you know, someone that he can fall back on when his first-choice midfielders are not fit. And that was also down to how erratic Fred is in form and, you know, in possession and, you know, just like Fred is moody. He can be a great substitute, but is he a good long-term option for a team that wants to compete for the title? Probably not. So I think Fred will definitely be let go of. Bissaka will stay. In defense, I think it's time up for Harry Maguire. I think it's just like it's not working out for him. There's just too much pressure from the fans. People don't view him as a leader. And I think he stopped viewing himself as a leader. Like, you know, I've often seen him at least give out speeches or, you know, like talk, motivate players. But what I saw during that penalty shootout of him just standing in a corner, just, you know, just not even saying anything. He's just completely beaten down. And I think he needs a change of environment to, you know, find himself and find his form again. I think a move to Italy would probably do great for his career, but that's probably a topic for another day. But yeah, I mean, I think these Fred and Maguire have been shortlisted to be sold by the club since actually November, where Samuel Luckhurst of the Manchester Evening News said that these two guys are going to be sold. And as the season has progressed, you can see how they don't really fit into Ten Hag's plans. And, you know, he's always preferred other players over these two guys. So I definitely see them leaving. And I see a ton of other players leaving, like, you know, players who we wanted to be let go of for years. Like Jones' contract is up. Tuanzebe's contract is up. I think Alex Tejes and Eric Bailly will be sold for a fee, how much ever lesser there is. Two of Ahmad Pelistri and Elanga will be loaned out. Weghorst will go back. Sabitzer will probably get, you know, we look into signing him potentially if Gravenberch or other midfield options aren't available. But yeah, I'm expecting a lot of people to leave United, and in return, just, you know, three or four priority positions to be filled, but really quality players. I think that's the way forward, and you know, that's something that we should be looking to do in the summer.
Yeah, just one thing to add to that, sorry, is that, like, what, just adding on what Ved said, Ten Hag finding use and quality out of players in certain situations should not be interpreted as, like Ved said, that being his first choice. Like, yeah, Fred probably isn't his first choice, but he's still been able to find use for him, and like a lot of use for him in the span where he has to have Fred. Same thing with De Gea. Like, if De Gea does get this contract, Ten Hag is going to find use for him and going to make it work. But that does not mean that's his first choice, right? So I think that just, again, it just shows the acumen of the manager.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Ten Hag has been pretty astute. And, you know, sort of just pivoting on to, you know, what is really a big week for us in the Premier League. We play one team that really doesn't have a manager, doesn't have a director of football. I think Ryan Mason did take over at Spurs. But they're an absolute shambles. They've probably played the worst 20 minutes I have ever seen any club play at any level against Newcastle. You saw Pedro Porro and Perisic playing fullback. Going to Spurs has never been as easy from a semantics point of view as it is going to be on Thursday. But keeping in mind United's away record, we're not too sure. The other game that we want to sort of quickly touch upon, and I think it's the bigger of the two. In fact, as we speak, Aston Villa have just gone over Spurs on the table. They're now at fifth spot. Unai Emery has been absolutely phenomenal. With the amount of injuries we have, I think we still go in second favourite, you know, against Villa as well. But Rusha, why don't I turn it to you to be able to give us some thoughts on what we should be expecting at Spurs? I can't tell if it's going to be a difficult game. I can't tell if it's going to be the away United that shows up. We still need to secure top four, and hopefully this win does that for us. But at the same time, Spurs have hit the absolute nadir. They've hit rock bottom. And what better time to play us? You know, what better time for us to play than right now? In fact, if Pochettino is announced before Thursday, and God forbid if United go one or two up in the first half, that place could really, really turn toxic, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It could not make for good viewing for Spurs fan. And, you know, hopefully we should capitalize on this. But over to you, Rusham, what do you think of the game?
I think you can never predict when there's a new manager, right? Like, people talk about this new manager bounce, and regardless of how, you know, it's not founded logic in terms of numbers, there's way too much evidence that it just works, right? Like you can never predict the new manager bounce thing. And like, you know, new manager bounce with like a relegation team, it's still a relegation team where the quality is still low. The team like Spurs, where the quality is undeniable, at least in some players. Like, I mean, if Son and Kane decide to turn up, I'm not saying we would lose for sure, but it suddenly becomes significantly harder than we're expecting it to be. I think from a United point of view, one thing to look out for is our attack. I think our attack has been misfiring for a few games now. You know, be that because of, like, you know, missing personnel or just, you know, a lot of like chopping and changing. So, you know, goals have dried up from Rashford and not really gone up from anyone else. So I think it'll be interesting to see. I think from United point of view, I would like to see us be more on the front foot. I would like to see us, you know, take the game to the Spurs team, which I'm sure the game plan will be that. But I'm interested to see how well we do it, because for this season running, we do need our attackers to start firing again. If it's not Rashford, then someone else. And I think the Spurs game is a good mix of, it's an away game, it's a quote-unquote big team, top six team, and it's an important game, but also it's against a weakened opponent. Like you said, they've hit rock bottom. And even when Spurs are at their best, their defense is not great. So I think it's a good balance of there's a challenge there, but it's still easy enough where you should expect our attackers to, grab this game by the scruff of the neck. So I'm really looking forward to hopefully one finally seeing our strongest front six with no suspensions, no injuries. So, Eriksen, Casemiro, Bruno, Rashford, Antony, and Martial. Just seeing that and, seeing how well they do against Spurs.
No, fantastic. I'm really looking forward to that game. Hopefully, we buried the ghosts in the past and we hopefully put 4 or 5 past them. Again, that's just a hope. I'm probably sure that's not going to happen, considering our lack of form in front of goal. But coming to form, I think, Edward, I just want you to sort of shed some light on what is a monstrous game on the Sunday, which is against Aston Villa. They've just come off a win against Fulham as we're talking, as we record this. They're absolutely flying. They've beaten Newcastle, the beating teams left, right, and center. How big a challenge do you think that is, and what do you think? What are your thoughts on the game overall?
No, definitely. I think that's the tougher game out of the two that we're playing this week for sure. Like, just a stat that I read right now, like just as we record this podcast, since Unai Emery took over, he took over in 17th place. No team in the Premier League has won more matches in the competition. That is 13 wins since he took over, as many as Arsenal. And I mean that's just a fantastic record. Like, Emery just found the fire in each player. Like you see Ashley Young playing out of his bloody skin. Like he's locking up wingers for fun at the right back position. And when you see things like this, you just realize the kind of culture that's being set in the team, the kind of environment that's being created where these, veterans are coming to the fore and leading from the front. I mean, Tyrone Mings is scoring goals and, putting in monstrous performances at the back. And he was being booed by Villa fans at Villa Park not too long back. So, every player is just feeding off confidence and, they're on a crazy, crazy run. And Ollie Watkins is among the top three goal contributions in 2023 among all the Premier League players. So he's just on fire right now. And it's going to be a big, big test for Victor Lindelof and Luke Shaw to handle in from Ollie Watkins. And, just their front three is just playing so well. Like, Emiliano Buendia is at his creative best right now. Like after years and years of, Gerrard trying to bring the best out of him. And then, Emery initially struggling, but now Buendia in that hole is really flourishing. And I think that the key part of their wheel is Douglas Luiz. Like Douglas Luiz is just so important for receiving the ball from the center backs, for breaking up play. And Emery's just come in and realized that Douglas Luiz and John McGinn are just two really, really important midfielders, and they need to be brought back to their best if Villa want to succeed. And towards the end of Gerrard's tenure, there were also reports of him having a rift with Douglas Luiz. And, John McGinn was one of the players who was vocal about Villa not being up to the mark and that Villa should have higher standards. Now, both these players are just at the top of their game right now. Like, John McGinn was man of the match today as well. Douglas Luiz has been putting in consistent performances even against the big teams. So, Unai Emery has just got this whole unit playing so well together in so little time. It's just fantastic. And, but again, I don't think United are going to lose against Aston Villa only because it's at Old Trafford. United have been really, really good at home. And, we'll definitely play on the front foot. I think we'll play more on the front foot against Villa than we will against Tottenham Hotspur, in fact. Because I'm actually, just to touch on that topic a bit, I think Tottenham Hotspur are going to come out with quite some force at their home ground. There's just too much pressure on them. And I think their front three does have a lot of quality in them to, cause United problems. Like Malacia versus Kulusevski or Lindelof versus Kane. Or I don't think Son is much of a problem. Like, I know now that I've said it, he's probably going to go ahead and score 3 goals tomorrow. But I don't think in this form, Son is a worry. But those two are. But the main problem, like, for Tottenham is retaining the ball in the midfield. There's no one in that midfield who can really, play like quick 1-2s or even hold the ball for more than 10 seconds without being tackled by, the opponent midfielders. I'm not even talking about Casemiro. It can be genuinely any midfielder at this point. But yeah, I'm quietly confident about that Villa game for some reason and not so much about the Tottenham game.
Lovely. I think it's going to be an exciting week. Hopefully, we get all 6 out of this week, which I'm not sure how realistic that is. I think, we can almost guarantee top 4 at that point. I'm really looking forward to this week. But, just to finish off this episode and just to get the predictions in, which is a non-United game, but probably the game of the season at the Etihad tomorrow. It's Manchester City versus Arsenal fighting for the title. It's not as important as it was a week ago, but it's still a big game. It's still a massive, massive game. And if Arsenal win this, who knows what can happen. They've dropped points to Southampton. But before going too much into it, Rusha, what do you think? What are your expectations from that game? Are you expecting a thrilling contest? Are you expecting a two-all? Are you expecting a nil-all? What do you think the Master and the Apprentice are thinking for tomorrow?
I there there's that you know there's just two there's two ways to go about this. One is like the thing that I hope will happen, and the one that I think will happen. And like my brain is just telling me it just seems like City have too much for Arsenal now, which is very unfortunate because I mean from my standpoint, I hate City and Arsenal. I hate every part of that club. I hate everything about them. I don't want either of them to be successful in any way, shape, or form. I know Advait's a closeted City fan, so he feels differently. But I genuinely, from in terms of like the story that Arteta has here and what it would mean, even if some people might consider it trivial, what it would mean for Arteta to win this. I think Arteta and this team to win this league would be great, which is why I want Arsenal to win. I don't think Arsenal will win. I was very buoyed by the fact that I thought Arsenal's team didn't have the experience to deal with the run-in. And then there was this patch in Jan-Feb where whenever they drew or lost a game or looked like they were shaky, they'd like win the next game like convincingly. And I was like, wait, maybe this team has like the experience in the bottle for this. And then the last three games have just completely changed that mindset. Like Arsenal still looked in phases so good against Southampton. Like they looked insane. Some of the interchange like in the front and at the top end of the pitch is actually unbelievable. But I just don't think I don't see how City lose the kind of touch they're in right now. It is ridiculous. If I had to give a prediction, I would predict 3-1 City, the same result as the game earlier in the season, the reverse fixture in the Premier League. But I really hope Arsenal win if I had to pick someone.
Fantastic. No, it's going to be an exciting game, but over to you, Advait. I know you're a big Pep fanboy. It's very hard to know what he's going to have for this game. I hope he doesn't overthink it, but if he was to think about this game, or if you were Pep, what would you do against this Arsenal side, and what are your predictions?
I mean, definitely Pep's going to stick with a 3-2-4-1 that's worked for him so well for the last few weeks. John Stones, the CDM, helping out Akanji defensively and, tracking runners to help Ruben Dias step up in midfield as well. It's just worked so beautifully. And I also think that one of the things that worked in Pep's favor and actually inspired him playing Bernardo Silva on the right-hand side of the 3-2-4-1 was the Arsenal game. Now, what happened was he brought in Akanji from RS and shifted Bernardo to the right wing. And Bernardo's pressing of Zinchenko and Gabriel was what led to two goals of Man City. So, that flank is again going to be so, so important. And Zinchenko should be back for tomorrow. He is already back. I think he played the last game. But yeah, how Zinchenko and Gabriel deal with that storming intense pressure of Bernardo Silva on that flank, and Haaland, continuously running around like he's some sort of a robot and on like steroids all the time. It's going to be really important how Arsenal handle that side of the game. But I think all in all, like Rushabh said, I just don't think Arsenal have the kind of mettle to play City out at the Etihad. Like City are going to be on the front foot, the crowd's going to be behind them. Everything's going in City's favor right now. And, just three draws on the trot, like that can be really, really demoralizing. And, especially like maybe Liverpool, all right, that's fine. But drawing to bottom place Southampton, that's just a whole new low. And I think mentally, that's a lot for Arsenal to take right now. Like, I don't think they've had the time to digest that result and what it means for the Premier League. And, just the media narrative around is just that it's City's title. It's City's title. It's City's title. And these young boys, like the average squad age is what, 24.5. They're probably just going to be beaten down by the pressure. And, when Zinchenko started crying on the bench when Liverpool scored the equalizer, it was like people just said, why is he crying this, that? Because he's been a part of a Pep team. He knows you cannot let that bald man sniff a league title. He's going to win it. you can't beat Pep Guardiola and league run-ins, and they've just given him, they've just opened the door for him, like just walk in and win it. And now, you know, you're going to his home ground with his players in full form, with his star striker being subbed off just when he was about to break the goal scoring record of the Premier League. Like, come on. People saying Pep didn't know what the situation was, that's wrong. Pep knew exactly what he was doing. He's left Haaland hungry to break the title tomorrow. And my prediction is honestly City 4-2. I think they're going to concede two while, you know, being so much on the front foot. But I think Erling Haaland's bagging a hat-trick tomorrow, breaking the goal-scoring record. And, you know, it's just going to be absolute chaos at City after. And it's going to end with Pep coming out in the press and saying, it's Arsenal are so, so good. So good. And my team are so good for beating Arsenal today. And, you know, Arteta just saying that these guys are so young. And, you know, that's just how the night's going to end. And I think that's my prediction.
Have you captained Haaland on FPL?
Yeah, I've captained him for now, but I'm probably going to change it to a triple captain. That's how confident I am.
I've captained him as well, but also you can't change him to triple captain. The game week started. Oh, no. Oh, yeah, the game week started. Yeah, the game week started. But anyway, I've also captained him, yeah.
I'll leave him for the double game week.
Yeah, no, I think that's fabulous. You know, it's an exciting game, and just to you know, quickly shed light on how difficult it is to beat this Manchester City side. I'm going to put a stat out before we end the podcast. In the title run-in when Liverpool won the title in during the COVID season, the 2021 season, there was a period of 365 days in which Liverpool only dropped 2 points. 2 points in a full year of Premier League football. And they came out with only one league title. So you can imagine how incredibly difficult it is to beat this Manchester City side. Liverpool fans are now looking at Arsenal and saying that, you know what, we told you. So this is what we feel. We play on a Saturday, we lose, we win 4-0, and we go back dejected, knowing that Manchester City is going to probably win the next one on Sunday, you know, quite comfortably. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to that game. I'm really looking forward to the Spurs game and the Villa game. As usual, a big week for Manchester United. We're coming to a close of the season, but the excitement only keeps on increasing. The challenges on Ten Hag continues to, you know, continue to increase. Bruno Fernandes, you know, potentially maybe out of the Spurs game. He's clearly, he didn't look fit after the ankle injury. But again, we look forward to, you know, hearing your feedback. We look forward to, you know, you sharing experiences with us for the game. And, you know, again, a very big thank you for listening, and thank you for tuning in. This is all from the United Road Podcast for today.